Please be seated. Good afternoon. Our third case of today is DSG Evergreen versus Town of Perry. Council, are you prepared to begin? Please do.
May it please the court. I'm Matthew J. Fleming of Murphy Desmond here in Madison, Wisconsin. My client, Dave Gale of DSG Evergreen Family Limited Partnership, is also present here today. Justices, we have a situation here where DSG some years ago was subjected to an involuntary real estate transaction. We call that process eminent domain. In that real estate transaction, the town of Perry promised to give DSG a new field road that was built to the same construction standards as the field road it would lose in the taking.
What were those construction standards?
The construction standards were not directly specified in either the jurisdictional offer or the petition. Now, there's a lot of history between the parties here. The field road itself had been built several years ago and itself had been subject to litigation between the parties. It was built in many respects similar to town road standards. It was built I think, an average of 21 feet. It had stormwater facilities to catch drainage. Drainage ways to deal with all that.
If this case went forward, presumably you would have to compare the road, the Newfield Road, to some set of standards to determine whether it was substantially the same as the Oldfield Road, correct?
Well, I understand that, but, Your Honor, you have to understand at the time, because everyone, at least we believed, everyone understood that the existing field road was separate and there was this history. When you're looking at how just compensation is determined, when you have a before and after, typically...
I know how that works.
Sure.
What I'm trying to get at is there a set of standards against which we can compare the new field road to determine whether it meets the same construction standards as the old field road?
No, I believe you would have to look at the old field road. But we understood, essentially what we were being told is that we were taking one and giving one. We were being promised something that was functionally equal.
At the time of the condemnation proceeding, there was no construction of this new road that we're fussing about, right?
Correct, yeah.
Okay, and the petition says, and I quote, this field road will be built to the same construction standards as the existing field road. And that was before the town took the 12.1 acres for a park, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so... were the standards under which that road was built ascertainable? I think that's what Justice Kelly is trying to ask you.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think you can look reasonably at what some of the basic functional aspects of any road are.
This road rather than any road?
Well, we've identified them in throughout this litigation. We believe that slope... width in particular and stormwater and drainage aspects are things that you can look at and compare two roads and say one is reasonably comparable to the other. I certainly concede that in retrospect, perhaps we ought to have pushed for more specific standards, but the fact of the matter is that when told we were going to be given something that was to the same standards as the other, we believe that we were going to be getting the functional equivalent.
You from the condemnation petition.
Sure.
It's not a promise to give you anything. It is an obligation from the town to do what they say they're going to do if, in fact, the property is condemned, right?
Correct. Okay. That was our understanding. And our understanding was that after the property was condemned, we would be getting a new field road built to the same construction standards. And it was only after just compensation trial was had, and we litigated about some other issues and litigated about what the compensation should be, that we realized that, oh, wait a minute, we don't apparently have the same idea as to what the same construction standards are.
What about the engineering reports? I mean, that clearly showed you that it wasn't even possible for them. You're talking about things like slope.
Correct.
And stormwater and all of those factors that you're saying you would use to compare, but you knew that it wasn't going to be the same as the road you had.
Just as that is a mistake, actually, and that's a mistake that the Court of Appeals made. First of all, I would like to note that the engineering report only noted a deficiency with the existing field road with respect to two aspects, the slope and site distances. And the reason why it thought that the new road would be different in those respects is because the report assumed that all that would need to be done to make the road the functional equivalent would have to be done within the confines of the easement that Perry provided us. We realized later, however, that that's not true. Perry owned the adjacent lands. It was not bound by the easement. All it needed to do was provide us a road that we could travel and stay within the easement. So if they needed to grade down up towards the top of the hill to, you know, in order, if you've got a hill that goes up a slope, how you bring the slope down is you dig down into the hill so the road can go up and over the top. All those things could happen outside the easement. Perry was not constrained by that. It was not constrained to go and shave off a little bit of hill outside of the easement area to make the site distances fine.
But the question then becomes claim preclusion, right? Because let's say that Perry was not constrained to any of that. And yet you knew at the time of a just compensation was determined, actually three aspects in which the proposed road would not meet the old. So in your brief at page 7 said the report concluded that applying the applicable standards, the proposed driveway area was not equivalent with the existing driveway because of steeper slopes, less width, and significantly poorer intersection site distance.
Actually, if you look at the report, I believe the report...
I'm quoting your brief, counsel.
I understand, and if that was said in my brief, that is an error, I believe. I think if you go to the actual report, it indicates that the easement is not equivalent because of inferior site distance and maximum slope characteristics. So if that's what our brief says, I believe that is an error. The report itself only talks about those two characteristics. We had no way of knowing, and the report didn't tell us it wouldn't be the same width. We had no way of knowing, and the report didn't tell us that we were going to have all kinds of drainage problems.
I'm actually looking at the executive summary of the engineering report on page 2. It says the private driveway was not equivalent with the existing driveway because of much steeper slopes, less width, and significantly poorer intersection site distance.
Yes, the executive summary, I believe, does say that. And you maybe recall now that I think if you look at the executive summary, it says that. But when you go to, it is on, for in our appendix, page 71, when you look to the actual analysis, it only cites to those two, to the two three. It does not say it's going to be inferior as to width.
All right, so let's accept that as a given. So aren't you precluded from litigating steeper slope and site intersection distance?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, because we realized that the report came to those conclusions for erroneous reasons.
When did you realize that?
I don't. It was sometime prior to trial. I was personally involved in the trial. I was not the lead attorney on it, so I do not recall how long before trial. I do recall being a part of the conversation where we determined that we would not get into it because we could not demonstrate that the conclusions of the report were not supported. And frankly, we didn't. We only wanted to litigate the things that we actually thought had to be litigated. There was a lot of things to go over, and when we realized that we likely could not make that case, we decided that that was not going to be a part of our case. We would effectively accept Perry's promise that would provide us with a road built to the same standards as our existing field road. I think it's helpful if you look at this in the context overall of how condemnation proceedings go. And I think a lot of the conclusions here make it sound as if all issues regarding just compensation are always necessarily going to be resolved at the time that just compensation is paid or determined by a jury. But think for a second of another alternative how this could have gone. Let's say that there was no history between the parties. Mr. Gale and the town board, they got along fine, and the town board came along and said, we want to buy 12 acres of your property. We know it's going to take away your field road, but in addition to paying you X thousand dollars, we are going to give you a new field road that's built the same construction standards as your old field road. And let's say Mr. Gale, you know, he thought that was just fine. He didn't see any need to hire experts, and we're just in the negotiation phase. And Mr. Gale agrees to sell that property for the price and the promise to build the field road. Now, what happens under those circumstances is that property owner is still allowed to challenge just compensation, but you have a shorter statute of limitations. In that case, it's 6 months. Now, let's say sometime afterwards, it's not until that 6 months passes that the road isn't built. Would we say that, oh, well, Mr. Gale, sorry, that's barred by the statute of limitations because that's all part of just compensation and you missed your time frame? No,
well,
I think...
Is it your argument that just compensation was the dollar amount for the 12.1 acres and that in addition to that, under the petition, the town obligated itself to build the road?
Effectively, yes.
And really, my question focuses on whether the road had to be part of the trial for just compensation or whether the trial was limited to the dollar payment for the 12.1 acre because the road was a separate obligation of the town. So whatever number you all ended up with at the trial, the town was still going to have to build the road, right?
Correct. If, for instance, the town had, along with the petition, if they had laid out plans and specifications that showed it was going to be different, and everyone was aware of that, then I think a claim preclusion argument would probably exist. We would have been fully aware. So, for instance, if you look at eminent domain statutes, it says that the jury is supposed to assume completion of the project on the date of just compensation, even if it's not done. It also says that you were supposed to consider the benefits a project may bring to a property. So let's think of a different scenario. Let's say I own some land, and the condemner's going to come in and build a brand-new, wider highway. They take additional land from me, but because it's a bigger, newer highway, that's going to make my land more valuable for commercial purposes.
Counsel, did you argue, I know the engineering report, as I recall, was introduced into evidence, correct?
Yes.
So the jury would have had it, but you didn't maybe make a bunch of arguments on it. Is that what I took?
What occurred, the report was introduced. No testimony was taken on the aspects of the driveway part, and the report itself never went back to the jury.
So the jury never reviewed it, is what you're saying?
That is correct.
So, okay.
And I think the other side, in our appendix, there's a portion of the June, I believe, 2nd motion hearing where I believe the town effectively conceded a judicial estoppel argument based on that.
So, is there anything else that would suggest that the deficiencies of the new road that was going to be built would have been a part of the calculation for the $312,000 that you were awarded?
Not that I'm aware, and that's one of the unique parts of this case, is just by nature, because what we understood to be offered was essentially a one-for-one exchange, it really sort of just was assumed as part of the deal and not discussed at all because it really wasn't an issue. We were there to litigate about whether we were going to have development rights and whether what they were condemning was actually, they were paying us enough for those rights. Those were the main issues here. We were not focused on a one-for-one exchange because the way the compensation formula works is if you have something in the beginning that's taken, but you're getting essentially the same thing in the after, they cancel each other out.
Follow up on that one for one. Before I do, though, I want to apologize to you. When I said I was reading from your brief earlier, I was reading from the town of Perry's brief.
Aha!
So that might go some ways to explain it. My apologies. On the one for one, is it the same thing to say that the new field road would be built to the same construction standards as the existing field road? Is that the same as saying the new field road will be the same as the existing?
Well, I don't think it can possibly mean that it's identical in every respect. But identical is not the same thing as saying that there wasn't an understanding about what the promise was.
Right. Well, so, in what I'm getting to is not the concept of identity, but where we go to look for the attributes that it must have. Right. So when we say when the petition says that it'll be built to the same construction standards, that suggests an external set of standards, external to that road. So you look at the existing road, you compare it to that standard, you say it meets those standards, right? So that seems different from saying the new road will meet the standards that the existing road currently exhibit.
Well, that's correct, but you also must remember, though, that this road itself greatly exceeded the town driveway ordinance standards and was actually never subject to any particular standards. That's what one of the earliest pieces of litigation through this case was resulted because DSG had built this road and the town tried to cite it for violation of the driveway ordinance. But based on the definitions of field roads, since there was nothing else that the road was being used for except for agricultural purposes, field roads the driveway ordinance standards didn't apply, and there were no town standards that applied to this. The standards that applied to this driveway were simply the standards by which DSG wanted the road built.
Council, I'd like you to elaborate on this standard, this same construction standard. Footnote 2 of the Court of Appeals opinion refers to a stipulation of the parties in the circuit court, which referred to the field road that was in place on DSG's property before the taking as, quote, the old driveway. And, of course, your opposing counsel indicates that the construction standards applicable to this field road are driveway construction standards. Can you respond to that?
Well, that's one thing, another factual oddity of this case that becomes a little confusing, because throughout we refer to these as road, driveway. These terms are also terms of art under the town's ordinances, and so some of this language is simply a function of the fact that we're trying to characterize or talk about things in a consistent way without necessarily falling into the terms of art. But the old driveway and the existing field road, these are the same things. And this old driveway or existing field road, whichever you call it, it wasn't built according to a permit from the town under the driveway ordinance. It vastly exceeds, as to many criteria, what the town driveway ordinance requires. I believe it would comply if we had applied for the permit and it was granted. I don't think that it violates any of the standards, but that's not the same thing to say that it is built to those standards, or that's the standard by which road is to be judged.
Does the record reflect, was it initially built to a standard of an old driveway, newly built? Oh, by that I mean, was it more of a driveway initially and then enlarged upon in some way?
The intention was for it to eventually function as a driveway. But the reason why it was not a driveway under the town ordinances for purposes of citing DSG for the violation is because the house and agricultural building that DSG planned to build was never allowed to be built. And it was that that led into, if the justices are at all familiar with the many cases that have arisen out of this, that's where everything took off from there. So, yes.
A driveway that goes nowhere becomes a field road.
Well, and it always was going to function as a field road as well, to give access to the farmer. DSG rents its fields to another farmer, and so that was always going to function as a field road as well, but not until there would be a home or agricultural buildings that not until then would it become a driveway for purposes of applying the town driveway ordinance.
You know, if you're going to take this back, if you prevail here and you get to go back to the trial court, what you're wanting to do is collect more money than you got from the jury. In order to be able to do that, you're going to have to be able to explain to the jury A, B, and C why the road that was built is not the same construction standards as the existing field road. And I don't hear you articulating that to us.
Well, we can see that it may be difficult, and that's one of the things that we may have to live with, is that the judge or jury, whoever decides this, ultimately decides that what we think are the same standards would not have been reasonably contemplated at the time. But that's not to say that anybody can't look at that language. I mean, like any contract, when you have a contract that's written and it's later determined that the parties didn't necessarily define the obligation as clearly as you would have liked them to, well, both parties may lose, but that doesn't mean you throw out the provision in its entirety. There was some intent there, and a judge or jury is going to have to figure out what that objective intent is, and we are going to have to probably demonstrate what reasonably is subsumed within that concept.
The petition for condemnation, was it ever signed by the property owners?
No, a petition for condemnation is not signed by the property owners.
Of course not. But you talk about it as a contract. Now, I can only assume you use that phraseology because eventually the property owners decided they wouldn't object to the taking, but they did object to the price they were paid, so you went to a jury. But I don't see how you make a petition into a contract.
Well, it's a contract insofar as the town states what it has obligated itself to do. And that's why I talk about this as a transaction, but it is an involuntary transaction. And the point is that when we can't come to an agreement, DSG doesn't get to walk away from the transaction because it doesn't like the terms. Instead, it has to go to a jury to finally say, this is the price that has to be paid. Perry, if you are going to do this, if you're going to take this land and you are going to give these benefits as a part of your project, then this is what you must pay. And that defines the contract, in my view, because this is not the only type of situation where you're going to see this. There's all kinds of projects where condemners will say, there are benefits being granted by this project that you, jury, must consider as an offset to compensation. But if that project is built in an entirely different way that does not comport with what the jury heard, you are not going to have just compensation. That's necessarily going to happen at a future date.
Counsel, just to make sure, I just want to make sure I understand your main thrust of your argument here, which is you're not asking us to sort of determine what construction standards means or anything along those lines. Asking us to say is let you make your case because they didn't give you what they were supposed to give you.
Correct.
Don't you have an obligation, though, to raise that in the proceeding initially? I know you're saying hindsight's 20/20, but here you're given this kind of vague term about construction standards, and you had the ability to challenge the offer that they made. You did that, in fact. How come you didn't also ask them to clarify what the terms were, what those construction standards were?
Just as every effort you make at the front end to try to renegotiate or challenge and litigate costs the property owner money. And that property owner may never get those costs back. You only get awarded litigation expenses under certain circumstances and don't get litigation expenses for issues you spend litigating that aren't successful. And also, back to the example I gave you, too, about what if this happened just as a negotiation that the parties agreed to before just compensation? You know, the statutes only say that the landowner gets to submit an appraisal for reimbursement, but they don't get to go out and hire engineers and do all this analysis. The burden in eminent domain is upon the condemner to define their taking, to make sure that there aren't going to be questions later, to make sure that they say, this is exactly what we're going to do. And if they fail to do that, and these kind of disputes happen because the condemner fails to do that, then it should not be the property owner that loses out.
What about at the jury trial, though? I get what you're saying, but so now you're at the jury trial. You're having the jury trial. Instead of instructing the jury that this is all taken care of, don't consider it, what about saying, hey, this is something that we're not having, we just want the other piece of this. This part is not part of the litigation.
The principle is the same, though. It's still time you have to spend. And if you understand that component as being something other than what it was, we just didn't understand it for what it was until we saw what was built. I mean, yes, in retrospect, seeing what happened, yeah, we would have at least pushed one way or the other. Maybe we had some way to narrow things down or do something about it, but we believe that that was an acceptable provision that was not worth our time and expense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Mark Steichen. I'm an attorney with Boardman and Clark here in Madison, and I have the privilege of representing the town of Perry. The town board, the town treasurer, and the town clerk are here in person. If we address the claim preclusion argument first, claim preclusion deals with not what was actually litigated, but what could have been litigated in the underlying procedure. Now, with a partial taking, there are two different methods of computing compensation, but the only one at issue here is you take the value of the entire property before the taking, and then you compare that to the value of the property after the taking, immediately after the taking, assuming the completion of the public project. So one of the critical things that attorneys have to do whenever you are dealing with a partial taking condemnation is to determine what is that public project. Because if you don't know that, there's no way to determine what the value of that property is after that project is completed. It's as simple as that.
Well, didn't the petition tell him what that was going to be?
Yes.
The petition told him he was going to get a road built to the same standards.
Yes. It said construction standards.
Sure.
And
so now he doesn't know whether the town's going to comply with that in advance, right?
Well, for purposes of valuation, it's assumed that the town will comply with that.
Oh, I know. And but we're talking about claim preclusion. What could he have litigated during this phase? And the question I have is, well, if he's promised a road built to the same construction standards, how is he supposed to know that the town, in his telling, won't eventually comply with that?
If a condemnor, if a property owner reads a petition and says, I'm not sure what this means, it's vague.
And he's not saying he doesn't know what it means.
Okay.
He's saying, here's what I was promised, a road built to the same construction standards, and I assumed that was going to happen. In town of Perry, it turns out, you flunked that test. You did not build a road to the same construction standards. Now, let's set aside whether, in fact, it met those standards, right? He can't actually litigate that until he sees what the road looks like, can he?
What could be litigated is what construction standards mean, and we know that not only could that have been litigated, it was. We look to the engineering report, and when it talks about construction standards, the only thing it's referring to are the ordinance standards of the town for driveways, because it was conceded that road had been built to driveway standards. The reason it had been constructed to driveway standards, because as the other attorney mentioned, the plan was to build a house. And so they had built the house, they had leveled some area for the house and another building. So when And if they were able to build that house, they had the driveway in place.
The jury's task was to calculate compensation, assuming that the town completed the new field road meeting the specifications of the petition.
Correct.
So if the claim now is that the town didn't meet the specifications of the petition, you're saying there's no recourse?
In other cases, there might be recourse. What I'm arguing is that the interpretation of the petition was an essential question in the earlier litigation. And we know not only could they have raised it, they did. And how do we know that? We turn to their engineering report.
So tell me about how the engineering report was used in the trial.
As far as I understand, and I was not involved in that trial, and what we stipulated to was that the engineering report was introduced into evidence by DSG. We're not saying that there was anything in the transcript where witnesses were asked about that or whether the jury considered it. That's irrelevant to the doctrine of claim preclusion. They could have argued it. Now, in the Court of Appeals decision...
But when a party assumes that certain specifications are going to be met, you won't litigate whether those specifications were met until you know that they weren't. So that's where you're losing me a little bit. I know you're arguing about the engineer's report and the significance of that, but how is that dispositive if the jury assumed that the specifications were met?
What the reason it's relevant is that it addresses construction standards. And the petition talks about construction standards. Construction standards were understood by DSG at the time to mean the road construction standards of the town ordinance and the county ordinance. If it had meant, if DSG had understood it at that time to simply mean that the new field road will have the same physical characteristics as the old road, there would have been no need to refer at all to the construction standards in those ordinances. It simply would have been irrelevant.
So where in the record does it say that DSG understood what the construction standards were?
And stipulated.
And stipulated to it.
Well, the reason why I keep coming back to the engineering report is this was not the town's...
No, where in the record is that?
I don't have the exact citation, but the engineering report was included in the record. It was stipulated that engineering report was introduced in the compensation trial.
So your position that DSG stipulated to the standards is derivative of the simple fact that it was stipulated that the engineering report was in evidence.
The interpretation. We have a written stipulation in this case.
So you say that the construction standards were actually litigated, and that's what I'm looking for. Where in the record does it show that it was actually litigated?
Well, when I say actually litigated, we're not talking about issue preclusion. I'm not saying that issue was decided.
You said it was actually litigated. If it's not, that's fine, and we'll move on.
What I meant by that was that that question arose and that question was addressed in the engineering report.
Okay, so it's in a report, and that's sufficient in your mind to say the issue of what the construction standards were going to be, that's sufficient in your mind to have raised it?
Yes.
Is that something you felt compelled to respond to?
I was not involved in the compensation.
Your side.
Pardon?
Your side. Is that sufficient, simply introduction of the engineering report, does that put the town of Perry on notice that the question of construction standards is now a live issue?
Yes. And as far as I'm aware, there was no engineering report by the town saying, no, those are not the construction standards.
So where in the record would I find an indication that the town of Perry understood that the issue of construction standards was a live issue?
I think the the conclusion is from there being no dispute that those were the standards.
See, that actually suggests the opposite to me. It suggests to me that nobody was thinking that that was an issue.
Well,
but if nobody talked about it, how do we come to a conclusion that that was at issue because nobody talked about it?
The Court of Appeals decision that was taken from the appeal of the compensation trial talked about this issue. Apparently, at the time, the town's attorney was arguing on appeal that the difference in the quality of the access, there's a question under whether that's accessible. There's a line of cases from this court talking about whether you're entitled to compensation because of the quality of access. And the Court of Appeals decision says DSG's response was that it wasn't relevant not because it wasn't potentially an issue. It was not relevant because DSG's tactical position was to focus on the quality of the property based on the road frontage. The big issue in the compensation trial and DSG's argument was, before the taking, we had lots of frontage on this county highway. Now, in the aftertaking, we don't have as much road frontage. And the road frontage is key to whether or not and to what extent you're able to develop land for residential purposes. There are minimum lot size and minimum frontage requirements if you're going to develop the land. And so the argument that they focused on was how much frontage, not because they couldn't have argued the access, but they thought they would get more money arguing it the other way.
So what would this have looked like? What should it have looked like? So the compensation trial is underway, and the engineering report has been submitted, and your position is that if there's going to be any dispute about the standards to which this was to be constructed, that's the time to have brought it out. So what would that have looked like? What was DSG supposed to do?
Well, what it would have looked like, the plaintiff would be the first one to submit its expert reports. Then the town would have submitted its expert
report. Why would he do that?
I'm sorry?
Why would he do that?
Why would DSG submit
a... He has a condemnation petition that says that the new roadway will be built to the same construction standards as the old. Why would he spend any time litigating over making sure that the town of Perry is going to build a new road according to the same construction standards as the old?
If, at the time, DSG really had thought that it meant same physical characteristics, and assuming that were a reasonable construction at the time, we know that that is not the case. If that was DSG's understanding at the time, the engineering report wouldn't have had to address the driveway ordinance standards or the county ordinance standards at all. What it did was to say, all right, the petition says that it will build this new road to the same construction standards. It says here are the applicable construction standards, and it lays out the ordinance requirements. And then it says, all right, you complete the public project, which means you've only built it to these standards. Now you compare what the public project will be to what the property was like in the before condition. That's how we know that DSG not only could have contemplated it, it did actually contemplate it.
Counsel, would you still be arguing claim preclusion if the engineering report was not introduced into evidence?
Yes, I think there would still be claim preclusion. And the reason is that it is an essential issue in any partial takings case to what completion of the project looks like. And so it's incumbent upon both sides to understand what that is. And one of the ways, if there were in fact any question, that there's discovery, if it's too vague, then or impossible, then it can be handled either in a motion in limine to exclude it, or a right to take challenge.
If there's a disagreement about it, is the logical result of your argument that If there is an understanding after the fact that is different between the parties, that that cannot be litigated because it could have been before?
I want to make sure I understand the question. Is the court asking if there was a subsequent interpretation after the compensation?
So the road is built. The road is built. Again, accepting your premise that the value of the land, obviously, is going to have to contemplate something being completed. That's argued about. It's litigated. It's presented to the jury. But suppose after the fact it comes up that there is a disagreement that no one contemplated at all, but that has a measurable, meaningful difference. Is your argument that that's always precluded because it's something that could have and should have been vetted out in terms of what the promise that the town made, was going to look like?
It's hard to say that categorically there could never be circumstance, but these cases depend so much on the facts of each individual case. I can't think of a case off the top of my head, a situation in which that would be true, but I can't categorically say no, there would never be the opportunity. If for some reason there's no way one could figure out at the time, if there weren't, the terms of art, as counsel mentioned, that Field Road is a term of art at the time, that if construction standards is understood by professionals to mean government standards, if you didn't have that kind of specificity, it's possible, I think.
Counsel, I want to return to the engineer's report for a moment, because if we accept your argument, that if, as I understand it, that DSG was on notice that the field road could not be built in accordance with construction standards based on the engineer's report. In fact, it says the standard was not able to be met, but it says within the easement. So if I understand DSG's argument, it's that, well, the town wasn't restricted to building within the easement, so therefore DSG should be able to argue to a jury that it didn't know that the town was not going to build it in accordance with the construction standards, even if we accept the town's characterization of those as being the town, county, state, and federal standards for public roads that are laid out in the report.
Two responses. The argument supposes then that what DSG is relying on is not what was promised in the petition, but something beyond what was promised, because the easements are specified, the location is specified. But we have an example of exactly that. The town, part of the petition said, you want road frontage, DSG, at some point in the future, you could expand this and make it a town road, paved town road, meeting all of the town road standards, and the town road will accept a dedication of that. But that's at DSG's expense. DSG's engineers said it's impossible to build that within the easements that were granted. The town then offered to provide additional easements that would make that possible. DSG moved in limine in the compensation trial to exclude that because that was not in place at the time of the petition. So they won it both ways. They successfully argued in the compensation trial that the town couldn't rely on something that was outside of the prescribed easement. Now, in this case, they want to argue that, maybe the town would have given something beyond the petition. They can't have it both ways.
Counsel, would you give your best argument on the issue that addresses whether or not there can be a private cause of action, please?
Yes. Two main points. In order for there to be a mandate, number one, the statute has to say there's an imperative duty. There's no language in Section 8250 or anywhere else in the statutes that says roads must be built to that standard. And even if there were such an imperative duty to the public, there has to be clear indication from the legislature, the Laney case says beyond a reasonable doubt, that it was intended to provide civil responsibility for individuals, not just the protection of the public.
How about this for a mandate? It comes from McCord versus Sylvester. That says if the landowner is to be deprived of pecuniary compensation by reason of some benefit to be gained by him in the future, then such benefit must, so far as human wisdom and foresight can go, be secured to him absolutely and without any unnecessary qualification or uncertainty. Would that do for a mandate?
Is that one of the early cases from the 1920s?
It's been part of our law for 100 and almost 50 years.
That's been superseded by statute, and what the legislature has said is you have to assume completion of the public project.
Yes, that actually is not superseded by it. It modifies that.
And so the question then becomes, what is the public project that has to be completed?
Well, the road that was promised, yes?
I'm sorry?
The road that was promised.
That was promised, yes.
Yes. And so if the town does not deliver, then it seems to me that we have a 146-year-old mandate and a statutory mandate that it be provided.
As I read the early cases, you weren't supposed to allow even the assumption that the project would be completed, that there was no obligation to accept promises to do things like maintain a pedestrian way, or that this is what it will look like in the after condition. That is how I understood those cases. And now the legislature has said you look at the completion of the public project. And public projects these days, I mean, they're pretty well documented. There are specific easements that went along with the petition. So I think there is that clarity. May I just finish my response to Justice
Please.
Bradley? So the first question was whether there's an imperative duty at all. Even if there were, there's no evidence that this was intended to be a private right of action. And I just wanted to note that that DSG conceded that point in the hearing on February 23rd, 2017. The court asked, the circuit court, none of the specific statutes at issue or the ordinance at issue themselves explicitly create a right of action in your clients. And the answer was that's correct. And what DSG was relying on solely at that time was the declaratory judgment statute. And as the trial court had pointed out, the declaratory judgment statute doesn't create rights. It's a process for determining what those rights are. So DSG has conceded that point. Lastly, as far as this notion about what DSG contemplated as construction standards, there are actually four engineering reports in the record. And what's central is that the report in the compensation trial, a report by the same company immediately after the road was constructed, both when they talk about construction standards are looking at the ordinance standards. There was another engineering report by the same firm in June of 2012, which was provided to the town under a cover letter from DSG's attorney in 2013, in which it said the old road was constructed to town road standards, except it wasn't paved. Paving is not a state requirement, it's a town requirement. So construction standards, they referred to the town road standards. It's not until the expert report in this case in December of 2016 that we have a report which doesn't even reference standards. It simply says, what are the characteristics of the old road? What are the characteristics of the new road? So this argument that we had no idea, had no way of knowing what construction standards meant, or that we actually had an understanding that it meant same physical characteristics, that's belied by the entire record.
What do we make, though, and I know you referred to this earlier, of the statutory requirement in 3209 sub 6 that says specifically that that they are to assume the project is completed. So you're now saying they had an obligation to litigate that issue of whether it was completed to the right standards at the time or would be completed to the right standards at the time, but we have a specific statute that says you're supposed to assume completion of the project. So how are they supposed to raise it in that context?
My argument is not that they would have known whether or not the road would be constructed to those standards at a later date. My argument is that they had a responsibility to determine what the public project was, what construction standards meant in the context of the petition, and if it wasn't clear, they had the opportunity to file a motion in limine or right to take challenge, which is something they did with the town road. They said, we have an engineering report. We figured what's possible applying construction standards. It's impossible. That promise can't be kept. Therefore, the jury can't consider it. It's the same as the field road. They have their report saying you can't build exactly the same road. The new road in the location is going to be steeper, narrower, doesn't have room for stormwater retention, in his opinion. So it's not whether or not hypothetically it would have been possible. We know that not only was it possible, but they actually looked at that question. Now, whether they pushed that argument or chose for tactical reasons to push a different argument to the jury makes absolutely no difference to the doctrine of claim preclusion.
But what you said earlier is that it didn't matter if that report was actually introduced. So what if they had never hired an engineer? You're saying they still had an obligation to clarify standards at the hearing through that trial court? They would have had to ask for a motion in limine, even if, let's say, there's no engineering report, we have no idea, and then later the road gets built and they say, whoa, this isn't what we had. They somehow have to raise that at the time of the taking.
What they would have had to address at the time of the taking was, what is completion of the public project? What does that mean? What is that going to look like? If it turns out that the project isn't completed in accordance with those standards and it affects the value of the property, then conceivably there could be some remedy.
How? That's what I'm asking. How would you remedy? You're saying you're precluded. You've got claim preclusion and you've got no cause of action under the statute. Let's say the standards meant exactly what they get exactly what they had and that they do not have exactly what they had. So let's just take it from there. How are they supposed to get what they had? They can't sue the town under this statute, right?
It's not clear what the remedy would be. I don't think it would be mandamus. If you had a $100 million highway project, and as part of that project, you took away access to that property, so it doesn't have any value, and now but you promised you were going to, as part of the project, give them alternate access. Build it, and you don't do it according to the plans, and now they have no access. I don't think it's mandamus that the state has to build a $100 million project. I think it would relate to saying, all right, you were compensated based on completion of the public project. That turned out not to be the case. Then it's probably a matter of comparing what the difference is in compensation, whether or not it made any difference. Now, in this case, that then would bring us squarely into the doctrine that a landowner is generally not entitled to compensation based on the quality of access as long as there is access. But in theory, yes, I think there are cases in which there could be compensation. It's not clear what that would be. I don't think it would be mandamus. I think it would be more in the nature you have to go back and say, what's the difference in value of the property as promised versus the value of the property as it was actually completed when that actual completion is not consistent with the public project.
Counsel, I want to look at you to respond to the Court of Appeals opinion where in paragraph 4, the Court of Appeals in this case states, we conclude that neither 8250 nor the town ordinances provide a private right of action in favor of DSG in these circumstances. What do you understand to be these circumstances relied upon by the Court of Appeals. That usually is a red flag for it's a more narrow opinion. So what are these circumstances that drive this conclusion?
I think it's the particular, we have a highway, we have a road that comes under the definition of a highway. It was never laid out as a town road. It was never even laid out under Chapter 82 as a town highway. It was laid out under Chapter 27 as a park town road. If you got into another circumstance, and looking at the entire ordinances, the only places that I found significance of whether or not something has to comply with the standards in 8250 relate to general transportation aids and then special aids for local road improvements. General transportation aids can be for basically the parkway would meet the definition because it's a definition under Chapter 340.
It could be, but boy, I don't see this opinion leading me to think, oh, what they're thinking about is the general transportation aids. There was something unique here that under these circumstances, under other circumstances, yes, a cause of action could be maintained, but not here. Why not here?
I'm not sure if they were talking about there could be different statutes where there would be a private right of action. I wasn't quite sure what they meant by that, frankly.
Do you think there's ever a time under 8250 when there's a private right of action? And if so, what would it be?
No, I don't think that there would be. I think the standards in there are for the benefit of the public.
So the big piece there, you know, you laid out the two factors, but the big piece from your is that there's no clear legislative language giving a private right of action under 8250 under any circumstances. Is that the thrust of the argument there?
Two parts is there's nothing in the statutes that requires the town to build all town roads to that standard. And second, even if there were, there's nothing that indicates that it's a private right of action. I see my time is up.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
If the issue is what did DSG understand at the time, and this is supposed to be demonstrated by the engineer's report, I again direct the justice's attention to page 71 of our appendix. Comparison to existing access. The proposed easement is intended to provide equivalent access as the existing driveway to the Gale property. However, comparing the proposed location and design with the existing location as constructed parameters shows that the proposed and existing driveways are not equivalent for the following criteria. That was our understanding. That's how the case was tried. The idea that we actually thought it was only going to be to the town road standards, which prescribed standards which were much below what our existing driveway was, or existing field road was, is simply not true.
Make your best argument for the private, why you have a private right of action in legislative.
I'll move on to that, yes. This doctrine of a private right of action, in my opinion, does not apply to instances where you are trying to hold the government to comply with clear statutory standards. The Cabot case and the Marish case are two examples, both highway cases, where the court has entertained mandamus or declaratory judgment actions to hold the local government responsible for what their obligations are under statutes. Now, the outcomes, particularly in the Cabot case, are a little bit different because, one, the issues were different. In Cabot, for instance, they were trying to get maintenance to a certain standard, but the court said they're only required to keep it open and passable. As far as maintenance was concerned, there was another statutory process. Here, what we are talking about is the standard for initial construction. And that's for all highways, I believe the statute says, after 1991-ish. It's in the statute, though. And the reason why this is mandatory, because the statute says these are minimum standards. And subsection 2 of that same statute says that that in order to build it to different standards, you need to ask the DOT for permission. The Department of Transportation can grant you permission to do something to different standards if it's in the public interest. So why would the DOT have to give permission to do something to a different standard if that was not a standard that the municipality was required to follow? They went through a formal declaration process. They adopted this ordinance and went, or I'm sorry, a resolution to declare this a town park road, something that doesn't have any.
Council, can you focus just on, I understand the idea that maybe there'd be some clear standards there, but focus on this, what we have said in the past, is that a clear language that authorizes a private right of action. Can you focus on that part of the argument?
Well, the courts have never applied that to this sort of circumstance. That rule arises from the Restatement Second of Torts, Section 286. And the danger that you're trying to avoid there is imposing statutes are not to be construed as changing common law duties unless the purpose to effect such change is clearly expressed. So this is primarily a tort action problem. When an environmental regulation establishes certain duties and you've got an enforcement regime that the DNR, for instance, is supposed to enforce, those standards aren't said to create a new duty on behalf of all people to follow that as the standard of care, for instance. Because it's been set up to protect the public, the DNR is supposed to enforce these things. If you apply that doctrine to mandamus and declaratory judgment actions, as the courts have in this case, you're completely eliminating the remedy of mandamus or declaratory judgment that was granted in Cabot and Marsh.
You didn't bring a mandamus action here, did you?
No, it was a declaratory judgment. But as I said, that's why I pointed it out to the Marsh case, because here there's also the added issue of trying to litigate what, in fact, is the status of this road. And that's precisely the instance where Marsh said that although that was brought as a mandamus, it was appropriate for the court to treat it as a declaratory judgment action, because there were these other issues to resolve, as there are in this case. The town disputes what the status of the road is.
Your declaratory judgment action, though, was seeking a judicial declaration that the town was required to build the new road to the statutory standards. That's what the Court of Appeals says. Is that correct? It sounds like a mandamus, even if it's captured and captioned as a declaratory judgment.
My time is up. May I answer?
You may answer her question.
You may be able to argue that it could have been as a mandamus, but nonetheless, the town still disputed that it was what the status of this is. That they're saying that somehow it's not a town road subject to these standards because it's something else, a town park road. So I think because the status of the road was still in doubt, I think under Marsh it's still appropriate as a declaratory judgment.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, thank you for very interesting arguments. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:10. We are adjourned.